great relief to see not so many questions today. Although I think those people who like early nights, they've probably taken a lot of the questions away and hidden them. So, here we are, the first questions. Dear Ajahn, I am a part-time Dhamma teacher. Same as me. Mainly to children and to sometimes adults. Could you kindly share with us your superb power of giving speeches? Without referring to prepared texts to be attacked. Okay, the best way of making speeches or whatever is to enjoy yourself. So, I know that sometimes, I shouldn't say this, a couple of my monks in here, sometimes the monks, I ask them, you want to give a talk? Oh, we can't give a talk. They can talk to each other for hours. What's the difference between giving a talk in public and giving a talk just to your friends? Because you are all my friends. I'm just talking to my friends. So, as long as you enjoy yourself, you have fun, you mess around. And when you enjoy things, it makes your mind very peaceful. I've already mentioned an important part of this retreat. If you enjoy your meditation, if you enjoy the present moment, put fun into silence, make the breath really beautiful, meditate backwards, whatever it is, just to make it interesting and play around. Because it's interesting, it grabs your attention, your mind becomes still and peaceful, and things flow. So that's when you give talks, you enjoy yourself, and then ideas just flow. But if you get tense and you try hard, then you lose your train of thought, you get tongue-tied, and you're just, your mind gets, as we said last night, constipated. Nothing comes out. So when you really relax, it's easy to give talks. And the other thing is, don't worry what other people think of you. Because if they hate my talks, oh, that's so wonderful, then I can be left alone, I don't have to work so hard. If they like your talks, oh, that's so wonderful, you can enjoy inspiring others. So whatever happens, it's great, so who cares what other people think about you? One of the stories in that book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, was the story of how we were taught to give public speeches. How we were taught we had to be prepared to give a talk at any time, but not to prepare your talks. And one of those stories, this was in the full moon day in February, which in that part of Thailand, northeast Thailand, is called Maga Puja. It's one of the big ceremonies of the year. And because it was a big ceremony, it was just next to Wesak. It was, you know, actually, just probably as many people went to the monastery for Maga Puja, the full moon in February, as they did in Wesak. And so because we were close by to our teacher's monastery, Ajahn Chah's monastery, Wat Pa Phong, we all went over there for the Maga Puja ceremony. And there were hundreds of monks there, and thousands of lay people. And when it came up, we did the chanting, it was time for the main talk. I expected Ajahn Chah would give that main talk, but every now and again he got fed up with talking, and so he wanted one of the monks to give a talk. And what he would do, he'd look down the line of monks. And if his eyes stopped at you, you were in big trouble. And he went past all these senior monks, all these great teachers. And he got down to the middle monks, and he went past them. At that time, I'd only been 4 years as a monk. And he came to me, and he went past. Oh, that was a close one. He went right to the end of the line, and he came back again. And have a guess whose eyes he stopped at. Brahma Wangso, he said, get up and give the talk. In front of my teacher, his hundreds of monks, and his thousands of lay people in time. He didn't have any choice, he just went up and did it. That's how we were trained. Any time, any place, you can go and give a talk. And of course, sometimes you really just messed up and no one sort of understood what you were talking about. But that wasn't the point, you just did it. And Ajahn Sumedho's story, which is also in that book, it was not just a great occasion, just the ordinary the moon night once a week when people go to the temple. And it was maybe at that time, maybe 100 or 150 or so lay people there listening to the talk. And he asked Ajahn Sumedho to give the talk that evening. And so Ajahn Sumedho gave a talk for 1 hour in Thai. And after an hour, he was reasonably good in Thai by that time. And he finished off and said, he finished the sermon, he was about to get down. And Ajahn Chah looked at him and said, another hour. And when your teacher says that, you've got no choice. So Ajahn Sumedho had to give another hour in Thai. And there's only so much Thai you know. After a while, you end up repeating yourselves. And by the end of the second hour, no one was paying attention. They're just talking to themselves or sort of sleeping. But, he did it because it's for your teacher. So after 2 hours, he got to go down. Another hour! Oh, no! And so he started off again, and people left the room. And those who did leave the room were snoring. So by that time, even the wall lizards were all asleep. He did 3 hours. And of course, there was huge pauses while he was trying to think of something new to say. He was thinking then and saying something. And even the monks had left except Ajahn Chah. And that 3 hours gone by. And then he got to finish his 3 hours. And Ajahn Chah said, another hour! He had to do 4 hours. And the only person listening, I don't know if he was really listening, was Ajahn Chah. And he let him go after 4 hours. And Ajahn Sumedho said he likely plumbed the very depths of the very worst audience response. That was the worst talk he could ever possibly give. So after that, it was easy. So the point was, his teacher, you don't care what other people think about you when you give a talk, just go and give it and relax. It's the same everything else you do in life, any social interaction, which is so concerned other people think of us. If we'd only just relax, then we'd be happy. Yeah, go on. Hi.
Would you train your monks like that?
Train my monks like that. Uh-huh. They'll all run away. No, actually, I'm much kinder than Ajahn Chah. Dear Ajahn, what does Buddhism say about ancestor worshipping? Yeah, that's very good. Okay, ancestor worshipping. It depends who your ancestors were. Got to find out who actually you're worshipping, first of all, otherwise you might get into big trouble. Because, many Australians, their ancestors were convicts, murderers. But no, it's not so much worshipping. I like the idea of like ancestor gratitude. Especially your living ancestors and your near ancestors. And I think it's a wonderful thing to respect and show gratitude to those who were your teachers, who sacrificed themselves for you. Because if you think of your parents or your grandparents, they did a lot to enable their children to grow up, to be healthy, give them a good education. Try and do the best to look after them. Even some people these days, they don't have too much respect for their parents because sometimes their parents weren't worthy of respect. Sometimes they did, sometimes abuse their kids and not really look after them. But in all parents, they try. There's always something in there you can find gratitude for. And when you find gratitude for your parents, it's a very beautiful emotion. And also gratitude for your grandparents and those who went before. That's why that when you look at a monastery, you have gratitude for the people who supported that monastery in the early days. You have gratitude for your teacher and all the people who fed you in the early days. And the idea of like gratitude and worshipping those who went before, even those who actually built this retreat center here, you have gratitude for that. Without that, we wouldn't be here. So we only have this beautiful feeling of gratitude of all who went before us. I think that's a very wonderful thing to do. It means we don't take the high quality of our life, the peace of our nations, the happiness and prosperity which we enjoy for granted. We're grateful for that and grateful of all the people who work so hard to get us to this place. So that's how I like ancestor worship. And when, in the Chinese tradition, when one maybe goes to the cemetery once a year to clean it up, when you remember your ancestors, I think it's a beautiful tradition because it's an expression of gratitude, realizing that so much sacrifice goes in our communities to make happiness and well-being for our children, our children's children. That's an important part of selflessness, of giving, of contributing to the welfare of everybody. I think it's a wonderful thing to do. Any questions about that? Like any tradition, it's actually how you do it, what you make of it. Now you can do that ancestor worship and just light some incense and just go away afterwards and not really understanding why it's, you know, why your grandmother did this and why you just do it because she did it. Understand why and make something out of it. It becomes very beautiful traditions. Okay, next question. Dear Ajahn Brahm, when one contemplates before eating that this food is taken for the purpose of cultivating this noble practice to freedom and to share the merits to all who have supported its cultivation, will this remove any unwholesome arising? Yeah, because whenever you do anything beautiful, wholesome, pure, and you understand what that is, it feels good. When you've got pure things in the mind, you can't have impure things in the mind. And so that's one way of avoiding unwholesome states, is having lots of good states in the mind. That's why if you're happy, you can't get angry. Now sometimes the little things which will make you angry, now when you're just so happy and blissed out, nothing can make you angry. You know, if I get to nice deep meditation, I find all my monks have run away and got married, and the monastery is burnt down, and the Buddhist society in Perth has been all evangelized to be Christians. I could remember, but oh, who cares? Let go. You can't get angry about anything. This is why I sing about when you've got happiness in, the unpleasant emotions just can't come in. Which is why if you haven't got positive emotions in your mind, you always get, it gets replaced by negative ones. If you haven't got flowers in your garden, the weeds will grow. If you've got lots of flowers all over the place, where can the weeds grow? So that's why you cultivate flowers in your garden. And that's the best policy of weeding. The weeds just don't grow if you've got too many flowers there. You've got respect for your ancestors, you've got gratitude, you've got forgiveness, you've got peace, you've got generosity. You've got these wonderful emotions. And that way, the negative ones just can't come in. So if you cultivate, this food is taken for the purpose of cultivating the noble practice to freedom, or out of gratitude, whatever it is, then that noble thought will keep the wholesome quality strong in your mind. Okay? Very good. It's called substitution. One of the ways of overcoming the unwholesome qualities. Dear Ajahn, you mentioned that a person who is not yet, I'm not going to start out one of these the agony aunt columns in newspapers. Dear Ajahn, you mentioned a person who is not yet an Arya passed away in jhana. The rebirth will be in Deva realms. Upon expiry of lifespan, depending upon karma, the next rebirth is unlikely to be in the woeful realms. How is that so? The reason I ask is because some teachers of the Mahasi tradition asserted that jhana is difficult to attain in these times. Even if one were to attain jhana, passing away in jhana may not be a good thing. Rebirth in the Deva realms is not conducive to development of the practice. Upon expiry of lifespan, the rebirth is likely to be in the Upaya realms. That's the lower realms. I know that the surgeon has stopped the aspiration of many from practicing jhana. It would be most helpful if Ajahn could elaborate and clarify. That's not in the suttas. It's not in the suttas, in the original teachings of the Buddha, that jhana is difficult to attain in these times. Jhana is always easy to attain. People do it. It's very easy. You make it difficult. That's the easiest thing in the world, to let go. You don't have to do anything. What can be more easy than that? Just stop doing things. Just let go. Just be at peace. Easy thing to do. But you make it hard. Why? Because we want it. You make the difficulty. Just let go and these things just happen. So people do get jhanas in these times. It's not so difficult to attain. Sort of, you might as well just say, what else do you want to do? Happiness in married life is hard to attain these days. True, isn't it? So why get married? But it's but it's, you know, to think like that, if it's worthwhile doing, you just go and do it. You might as well just say enlightenment is difficult to attain in these times. But you've got to do it, you might as well. So that's wrong, is difficult to attain in these times. I would ask, how do you know that jhana is difficult to attain in these times? Have you done a survey? Have you been scientific about this? And seeing all the monks and nuns, all the lay men and lay women, and ask them, do a nice survey. How long have you been practicing? How long have, you know, what jhanas have you got? And do a proper survey so you've got real grounds for saying it's difficult to attain in these times. I doubt that. Number two, even if one were to attain jhana, passing away jhana may not be a good thing. My goodness, why not? Because jhana is letting go. You're letting go. You're giving up your attachments. You're freeing yourself. It's a wholesome quality. The Buddha said, do not be afraid of jhanas. Develop them. Make much of them. So he said that. I believe the Buddha. So it is a good thing. An expired lifespan, their rebirth is likely to be in the prior realms. How can you say that? You've just got this beautiful high mind. High minds can't go to low places. And when I was a kid, no, not really a kid, sort of a youth, you know, sometimes you go out with your friends, sometimes you just go to a pub to have a quiet drink. But there's so many pubs, sort of, you know, in, you know, all over London, that some of the pubs would always be fights in an evening, especially a Friday, Saturday evening. I couldn't think, why does anyone go to a pub like that and know there's going to be like a fight, a punch-up? And sometimes, you know, people get broken noses, blood and stuff, call the ambulance. It's because some people like that. They want the fight. Some people, you know, they do, because of their karma or their inclinations, they go to those really, you know, low realms. Other people go to the high realms. Why is it sort of on a Friday night, some people go to Nolamal to hear a Dhamma talk, but other people just go to the casino to lose all their money and get drunk? So sometimes people will incline to good places. They're inclined to have beautiful people around them. Good people, kind people, generous people, people you can trust. So if you've got a mind which can get into a jhana, it gets into those jhanas, you are a very pure-hearted person. I already mentioned you have to have very, very good virtue to get into a jhana. It means in that life which you get jhanas, you have done huge amounts of merit. What did the Buddha say about merit? The different levels of merit? Just like giving a donation, say, to giving some food to a fish. 100 times that is giving food to a human being. 100 times that giving food to, like, the Sangha. Giving food to the noble Sangha. 1,000 times more than that is just taking the 5 precepts. 1,000 times, no, taking refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. 1,000 times that is, was it taking the 5 precepts? 1,000 times that is that one moment of liberation through loving kindness. That actually means the jhana liberation, for using loving kindness as your object, as your path. So, even just keeping the 5 precepts, keeping the 8 precepts, you've made more merit over the last few days than if you give billions of dollars to every monastery in the world. Very cheap way to make good merit, isn't it? This is what the Buddha said, you get much more merit this way. So imagine that to get into a jhana, how much merit you've made. How can you go to a lower realm with that sort of good merit? Impossible, I say. So I say that that's a lot of old baloney. Yes?
When talking about merit, I tend to like to think that people are pretty much the same regardless of whether they're, you know, what type of person they are. How is it that giving food to a homeless person would be, you know, less of a merit than, say, giving food to a full-time monk?
Okay, because where, you're asking, why is it the Buddha said that, say, giving food to a full-time monk or a nun is better than giving food to a homeless person? Because where does that energy go to? What's the consequence of that energy? If you give it to, like, especially like a noble person, like a stream winner, once returned, non-returned, or arahat, the food you give them, they're going to actually goes in their body, comes out their mouth with beautiful Dharma talks and helps so many people, inspires them to be good. You see the effect of that gift is huge. It's like, you know, you plant a seed in really good soil and you get huge amounts of mangoes and flowers, and it's lovely. You plant, you know, like a the same seed sort of in, you know, barren soil, and you love to get a weed if you're lucky. So it's actually the results of your gift. That's actually why that I mention this, and not just to raise money for monasteries and stuff, but sometimes people say, what do you want to give any donations to a monastery for? That just makes the monks fat. You give it to a hospital or give it to a school or stuff. But look, you know, what the, you know, like good monasteries, what good monks and nuns actually do, they teach the Dhamma, which solves just the pain in the people's hearts. And that's like an affliction which a lot of people don't see. People may look really healthy in this hall here, and then, you know, sometimes they go and kill themselves. Or they've got this incredible stress or guilt or pain from the past. And those are the big afflictions which human beings have. And those afflictions which no one can see. And that's what the spiritual path, the spiritual teachers, that's what we heal.
What if the person that you give the donation to, the food to, is a monk and later disrobes? Do you get downgraded in your terms of marriage?
It's one of the reflections which the monks have said by the Buddha. Yeah, actually it's true. What he said is true. He said, may the offerings of the faithful lay people, because of my practice, because of my attainments, may it be even more fruitful to them. So what you're saying is true. So that's why that, you know, that when we take your offerings, and you know, we try and make them as fruitful as possible, so you get the best possible return on your investment, basically, by being good monks, good nuns, and really working hard to liberate our minds.
Isn't that linking? It seems to take away. It seems that is no longer the karma of the act is no longer based on my intention. It seems to be more based on a combination of the intention and the consequence. If I give it to you, giving it to you as a monk, and that's my intention, and you're just a person in a costume, I mean, obviously it's not the case,
yeah.
You know, my intention would be the same, isn't that what?
No, it's actually, this is what the Buddha said, that the three parts of giving, it's the giver, and the person who receives, and what's in between.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and your intention is what's in between, why you give, who's giving it, and to whom. Affects the karma.
So what the person I give to does with that sustenance, essentially,
yeah,
influences the amount of merit.
Correct, yes. Intensity of the result. That's why they have all these strange things about sometimes somebody will just give like a bowl of rice to a Pacheka Buddha. Silent Buddha, and the result of that would just be huge happiness, wealth or prosperity for many, many lifetimes. That's why that if you do bad karma to, say, your mother or father, it stops you becoming enlightened. It's much different than if you do bad karma to not somebody else. So there is, in the world of karma, an effect on the person who is receive your actions or your speech.
Can you clarify your three? There was the intent,
yeah.
There was the what the
yeah.
target person does with
yeah.
that, and, so, and the other part of the giver.
Yeah, it's actually how you give it, basically. Whether you just throw it down, or you just give it with respect. Like, it's, basically, it's just the way you give. Yeah, that's something. But that's a good point, but that's, I can understand why the Buddha said that. The person you give to dies influence it. Okay for that one. Next question. What is Nama Rupa and Sankara? Okay. this in the context of the dependent origination, especially that's where Nama Rupa usually is, it's basically, to keep it simple, it's the object of consciousness. So you've got consciousness knowing, consciousness has to know something. The object of consciousness. It's an interesting point because you can't be just conscious but not conscious of, you're always conscious of something. Some people say they're aware, some say you're aware of what? You always must be aware of something, there must be some object of consciousness. Otherwise, if there's no object, there's no consciousness. If there's no consciousness, there's no object of consciousness. So it's people who say like a universal timeless consciousness. I say, conscious of what? It has to be some object of consciousness. So Nama Rupa is just the way that the Buddha talked about the objects of consciousness, the Rupa being the physical things, the Nama being the mental things, which is your object of consciousness. And Sankara just means like things which, literally means things which are made. In the context of dependent origination, it means like karma formations of body, speech or mind. So it's actually, again, this is where we get the will from. It's what you're doing, your speech, your actions. That's what the sankhara means in that context. In other contexts, it means it can mean many, many different things. It can be like the kaya sankhara, the bodily function in Anapanasati means your breath. So it literally means that. The chitta sankhara in Anapanasati, it means that the joy, the happiness which comes as a result of the mind, the mental happiness coming when you get to the stage of the beautiful breath. So sankhara has meanings in many, many different contexts. It literally means what is like formulated, built up, constructed. Is that okay? Yeah.
So in the jhana, have you got consciousness?
Yeah.
So is it consciousness of like happiness?
Very good question. That's the way you define what the jhanas are. That's actually their difference. Every jhana has got a different taste. And it's the different types of bliss which you have. So that's one of the reasons how you know what the jhanas are. What you're aware of, you're aware of bliss. Question number two, what type of bliss? What flavour? Just like you have ice cream, you've got vanilla, you've got chocolate, strawberry, or whatever else you have. They're all ice cream, but they've got slightly different flavour. And the jhanas have got different flavours. The first jhana, it's the flavour is just the joy of the body and the five senses have completely disappeared. It's the joy of vivekaja piti sukha, the joy of seclusion from the body and the senses. Oh, what peace not to have these senses bothering me, not to have this body bothering me. That's the cause of the joy. It's a particular type of happiness. And that's what you are focusing on. Just like you focus on the breath in breath meditation, sometimes you focus on like the present moment, in present moment awareness. You know, in loving kindness, you're focusing on loving kindness. In the jhanas, you focus on bliss. And each bliss is caused by letting go of something. That's why the stages of letting go. So the first jhana is the bliss caused by letting go of the body and the five senses. The second jhana is caused by a different type of bliss caused by full samadhi, letting go of all movement of the mind. You might even call that letting go of will completely. So the mind is absolutely still. It's the samadhi jhana, piti sukha. The joy built of absolute unity, oneness, stillness of mind. It's a different type of bliss. And the third jhana is the bliss where the pity aspect has just faded away. You've let go of the pity, you've just got the sukha. A different flavour of bliss altogether. And the fourth jhana is the bliss of equanimity. Absolute peace. Each one has got a different flavour of bliss to it. So actually, that's what you are observing. That's the object of your consciousness in jhanas, just four different types of ecstasy. Yeah?
Isn't that sort of like images in the first jhana?
No.
At any time?
No, no images, nothing. All you've got there is bliss. So you ask someone, what are you aware of? They say you're right, no, you're still just on the edge of jhana. Are you aware of, Davis flying around through the air, or beautiful sea. No, that's not the difference. Just one object. this. Which, first jhana it changes slightly, it pulsates, I call it the wobble. But in the other jhanas it's absolutely still, unchanging for a long period of time. That's where you get timeless. This was bliss. Couldn't see it change. 2 hours, 3 hours later. Oh, okay, let's just go further down for more questions here. Dear Ajahn, one committed one of the five precepts. In other words, I think one broke one of the five precepts. It's bad karma. How can we repay by creating good merits to gain back good karma? Okay, one of the best ways of creating good karma is meditating. So you broke a precept, but you only broke one precept, you kept four. 4-1. Profit. So why do you always focus on just a little precept which we broke? Why not focus on all the other precepts which you did keep? And focus on all those moments when you didn't break that precept. The problem is where we just look upon the bad karma we've done. That bad karma has got a good chance of ripening. And if you forgive it and let it go, and you focus on all your good karma, all the good precepts, the other four precepts which you did keep, and all the meditation, and go for refuge. My goodness, that's good stuff. So don't overreact to little mistakes. If you've broken a precept, acknowledge it, forgive yourself, and then learn from it. Try better next time. These are what's called training precepts. So you're expected to make mistakes. But the point is, you don't feel, oh, I can't keep these five precepts, I've broken them once. You can, you tried it. You made a mistake, see the consequences, now try again. Perfect them, you build them up. So it's not really that bad karma. You're making such good karma anyway by meditating here. That's a small thing, just a little glitch. Ajahn, if devas are kind, then what about Mara? Especially when you read in the sutras of particular maras try to stir up monks and nuns when they are meditating. That's a very good point. So most devas are kind. But Mara is the anomaly because, again, he's in this realm of like power. It's the bliss of power. I mean, why is it that when people get rich, now they can actually have all of the, if just to be coarse, all the sex, all the music, all of the food they ever want, they can have big yachts. Can't they be satisfied with that? No, they want an extra level of power, an extra level of joy. And that's like the joy of power. That's why rich people, they end up sort of joining politics or becoming head of CEO at big corporations and making even more money. So when you have that, the different levels of happiness in the Buddhist cosmology, you just start, you know, the ordinary happiness is in the lower deva realms. And then you get to things like people who enjoy creations, the nimana rati, the delight in creating. Those are like the, whenever you've created anything, you've been an artist, a painter, or you've, you know, written a beautiful song or whatever. Or even, I know, like in mathematics, you've just solved a problem, you've got this amazing theory. Whatever it is, in creation, it's a huge joy. And that's actually the pleasure of those who enjoy creating. That's a level of the heavenly realms. And above that is the level of people who exert power, the controllers. And I suppose that a person goes into that realm, first of all, because they've made a lot of good karma. But that wonderful saying by Lord Acton, that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's what happens to Mara, gets corrupted by power. Yeah.
Speaking of James, people who pray, when you pray to a deva, does it have any effect on the deva's behavior? And if people have contrary prayers, do you essentially a proxy battle between the devas? Because you want this.
My deva, yes. My deva is bigger than your deva. Sometimes, yes, sometimes the devas can assist. But a lot of time, I mean, the devas, you know, they've got better things to do, basically. Well, there's all these stories. There's that story about this couple who come to Serpentine. Some of you know who they are. But he was an Englishman. He married a Singapore girl. And he was visiting Singapore many years ago. And he was getting bored out of his mind. You know, while she visited all the relations, he didn't know what to do with himself. So his brothers-in-law invited him to the racetrack. You know, let's go, you know, see the horse racing. So, okay, I'll go along. I think they'll be anything better to do. So before they went to the racetrack, as many of you from Singapore would know, they visited one of the temples, one of the lucky temples, to light some incense and pray for good fortune. And when they got there, the place was a mess. So the brothers and their English brother-in-law got up some brooms, some mops, they cleaned it up. That was an important thing to do, clean those temples up. That's good karma, because see what happened next. Then they lit their incense and prayed for good luck. Then they went to the racetrack. You know what happened? They all lost. They lost quite badly. So I think, oh, okay, never mind. That happens. But that night, the Englishman had a dream of a horse race. And when he woke up, he remembered the name of the winning horse. This is a true story. This is not the joke. This is absolutely true. He remembered the name of the winning horse, and he thought, ah, it can't be true. But he looked in the Straits Times, you know, the daily paper of Singapore, and saw that a horse by that name was running in the race that afternoon. It really was a prophecy, an omen. True story. So immediately he rang his brothers-in-law and said, hey, look, I had this dream. I remember the name of the horse. It's running in the race today. Our prayers have been answered. We can get our money back. Come along. And his brothers-in-law said, listen, that temple was in Singapore. If there are any devas there or spirits, they'd be Chinese spirits. No Chinese spirit would give the name of a winning horse to an Englishman and forget about us. We never had any dreams. So he could not convince his brothers-in-law to go to the track. So he went by himself. He put a lot of money on that horse. That horse won. He made his money back and lots more. And when he got back and he told his brothers-in-law, they were so angry. Not at him, but the Chinese spirits. Oh, why don't they help us? They only helped the Englishman. That really hurt. So that's it. One occasion. It actually did work. But you know, they're very kind to whatever spirits were actually in that temple. And it worked. Sometimes it doesn't. But sometimes, who knows? Okay, next question. Ajahn, please help with this problem. Who am I? For who is I? If there is no I, no self. And who is the I? In may I be one, happy and peaceful. May I be free from harm, etc. Okay, that I is you. But that is who you is. I have this. This is actually in the history of Buddhism. That they used to have these debates. And they got some of these monks were very, very smart, and they used to face off at each other. You get, you know, this great monk from here and a great monk from there. And it'd be like entertainment. Because they didn't have TVs or other stuff. So all the villagers or the city people would come out to be a debate today with this monk and that monk. And for example, you know, those of you who know the Burmese monk, let's get Mahasi's side or Park's side. Let's have a debate between the two of them. That'd be really fun. Yeah, you go for that. I know years and years ago, remember, it was Rajneesh and Krishnamurti. And Krishnamurti, I think, was challenged Rajneesh to a debate. It didn't actually eventuate, but as soon as I heard that, I said, if that's going to happen, I want to go and see that. Because it would be interesting getting sort of people actually to debate together in the same stage. So these monks would debate together, and so there's this famous debate between this monk, Mahanama, and this other monk, I forget what his name was. And it started off with Mahanama, and he was like the smart guy, and this other guy ended up being a fool. He said, good morning, I'm Mahanama. And his adversary said, who's this I? He said, it's me. He said, who's me? Mahanama. And he said, who's Mahanama? I am. Who's I? He said, I. He said, it's you. who's you? He said, you, our dog. Who's a dog? You are. And he said, who's you? He said, me. Who's me? Mahanama. Who's Mahanama? I. Who's I? You. Who's you? A dog. Who's a dog? You are. Who's you? Me. Who's me? Mahanama. It's only when it ran about two or three times that this other guy realized what he'd been saying. He's only one just laughing. Because one that was being down to earth, the other one was being this really airy fairy realm of what an eye is and what the five canons are, depending on origination and attire. That actually happened, it was recorded in history. So sometimes be down to earth. So, who am I? Okay. You actually look and see, who is this I you take yourself to be? So first of all, eliminate all the obvious candidates for who the I is. It's not your body, so you cannot be Singaporean, Sri Lankan, Australian, or whatever, or Thai. That's not you, is it? That's just your body, so that's certainly not me. Put that aside. And so you're not a girl, you're not a boy. So put that aside. Isn't that wonderful? You don't have to worry about that. You're not old, you're not young. Put that aside. So get rid of all the obvious candidates first of all. And then you get to the nitty-gritty. Are you your mind? What is the mind? The two parts of the mind, the knower and the doer. Will. Are you the will? We talked about that this morning. In the deep meditation, you find, that's not me. You're not the one who does. That's a bit scary, but it's true. And later on, once you get rid of that, if I'm not the one who does, then at least I'm the one who knows. I'm the mind. I'm the consciousness. And you go in deep meditation, even that falls apart. So all the very last possible thing you can be has been taken away. You are nothing at all. Just a flow of cause and effect. And once you see that, oh, what a relief. I don't exist anymore. And I don't have to do anything. I don't have to care what people say about me because there's no one in here. Isn't that beautiful? You don't have to desire anymore. I don't know why people want to keep an eye. Sort of crazy to me. So actually that's who you are, or rather, who you are not. Next question. Dear Ajahn, just a good clarification of your comments. If a person is by nature kind, but a rather hot temper, often losing his temper. Why do you say his temper? Often losing their temper and is impatient. Is it more difficult for this person to meditate? However, it is not impossible for such a person to get the nimitta or jhanas. Please comment. Thanks. Yeah, if you're sort of hot, if you're hot in nature, it's very hard to get the jhanas because you've got no patience. And if that's the way you treat others, you're impatient and lose your temper, you lose your temper in your meditation. You know, some people do that. They've got their eyes closed. You rotten. You better get your act together as your bro. You can't do this. Come on. You're losing your temper to yourself. But please never do that. Because if you do that, after a while, it just bursts out to somebody else. You go criticize. You were talking today. All that means is you're not having fun in your meditation. So you go around criticizing other people. So, if you're having trouble, lovely stuff in your meditation, so peaceful, so quiet. You don't care at all if everybody just breaks their precepts and eats in the afternoon and talks around and just lays around. Who cares? Because you're having a great time. Most of the criticism comes because you're criticizing yourself. One who judges others is always judging of themselves. So if you're patient, you don't lose your temper with yourself, you don't lose it with others. And that means that if you don't lose it with others, meditation is very easy. So the jhanas and the nimitta are just so hard if you're impatient, if you can't let go, if you get angry, you've got ill will. Those are hindrances. So let them go. And you'll notice if you get a nimitta and you've been angry at somebody that day, that nimitta will have a big stain on it. It's what it looks like. You think, oh, what's that doing there? I said something really nasty to somebody today. There's an imprint on the mic. Okay, the next question, here we go. Dajahn Brahma was reminded of the young daughter who referred to her mother not caring for her, and her mother's brother who lives with her. The young daughter who referred to her mother not caring for her, and her mother's brother who lives with her. I wonder whether the mother is trying to teach them that they too can cook for themselves, being adults, without demanding from her for everything. Maybe the mother is working for a part-time. Maybe she creates time to do the charity work for people who can't care for themselves because of circumstances. I am very grateful to my children for the help they gave me with love when they hired, when they lived with me and continue to give even though they don't live with me anymore. It's very nice. So basically that, you know, if you have a mother who cares for you, you're very lucky. If a mother doesn't care for you, you're very lucky. If you have children who care for you, you're very lucky. If your children don't care for you, you're very lucky. You are. Very happy, you're very lucky. Lucky to be alive. If you've got really terrible children, they become your teachers. What it Socrates said? If you've got a very nice wife, you'll have a happy marriage. If you've got a horrible wife, you'll become a philosopher. Socrates said that. So as he was a philosopher and a very famous one, you can tell you what his wife is like. So he was very grateful to have such a hard wife. He was very, very lucky to have an unhappy marriage. So if you have a happy marriage, you're very lucky. If you have an unhappy marriage, you are very lucky. Because sometimes if you had a happy marriage, you wouldn't be here. Some of you. It's only because you're having a hard time and you say, I should go. So, that doesn't really matter. It's not matter what situation you experience in life. You can always make use of it. If you have a very difficult time and things always go wrong, if your husband cheats on you, and if your children just are terrible at school and they just don't want to work, and you've lost your job, and you come to Perth to hide from the debt collectors in Singapore, whatever else you're doing, then you're so lucky. Because all of those disasters, what are they called? They're called the truckload of dung, the poo, the fertilizer for your life. Because when things go wrong, they really sort of, they take away all your attachments to the world. What do I want to do that for? That's what the world is like. You don't get so caught up in things. You want to get out. And this is the way out. So this is way out Buddhism. How to get out of suffering. Because sometimes this was Ajahn Chah's teaching. Because we had all these mosquitoes in Thailand and they were just devouring. There were so many of them. And because the mosquitoes had been in Thailand for so long, they saw Westerners, it was Western food, and Western food was just a novelty for those years, the first time they see it. Now, I don't think they bother with it now, it doesn't taste as nice as Thai food, but anyway, at that time, they just swarmed one over you. And there was no mosquito curls, no mosquito screens on the windows, you just have to grin and bear it. And sometimes it was too much, and so sometimes we complain. Ajahn, can you help us? You know, with all these mosquitoes, can you find some place in Bangkok and get some mosquito repellent? It's all like a new times. You're used to it, but not like us Westerners. And he told us, Ajahn Mosquito has come to teach you the Dhamma. And that's what he was saying. It was like Ajahn Mosquito. He said, it was unpleasant, now that's your teacher. It's a very beautiful way of actually dealing with the problem. So it was just a teacher for you. And it was very true because that taught you a lot about yourself, about wanting, about craving, about pain. So when all the things go wrong in your life, that's your teacher. And you find the strictest teachers you have are the ones you know the most from. Just like me, I'm a very strict teacher. But that's why sometimes a hard teacher you do learn a lot. So if anything goes wrong in your life and you can't do anything about it, you're stuck with it, you tried your best, call that your teacher. That's your Ajahn. So if you've got a very, very difficult husband, call him Ajahn husband. If
you've got a very sore body, it's always got gut ache or something else, call it Ajahn gut ache. Whatever else you have. Because that becomes a teaching way. Okay, next question. Here we go. How to deal with fear? I have fear of darkness, fear of bad guys pouncing from behind, fear of ghosts and spirits, even though my precepts are kept. Is it a matter of faith and unwillingness to let go? There are serial rapists, murderers in the world, maybe in Perth. You know, they're actually just south of here. It's actually very close, it's Northbridge. That's the red light, the gang area of Perth. Maybe they might come here. Very close. Maybe they're already staking it out. Who knows? Whatever it is. Is it a matter of faith and our willingness to let go? There are several rapist murderers in the world that create fear and terror. How can they be forgiven if they instill so much fear? Fear for your children and loved ones. But stop being afraid. Because if you're afraid, very often what you're afraid of is actually happens. It's almost you make it happen because of fear. Remember that story which is in that little book, Open the Door of Your Heart, about Grasshopper? This was the time when I used to watch television. And there was a series on the television called Kung Fu. I didn't have very much, which was almost Buddhist. It was almost Buddhist. This had this old master there and said a few smart things every now and again. But this particular episode, I used to watch that every week. That was a must-see on the TV, like Kung Fu. So it was basically like most movies, just sex and violence, but it had this sort of spiritual sort of bent to it. But anyway, in this particular episode, it was like this little monk, Grasshopper, his name was. He was being trained by his old master. In this particular episode, the master said it was time for a special teaching. And he took little Grasshopper into a back room of the temple, which was normally kept locked. All the little novices were scared of that room because some terrible things had been said to happen inside. And now the master led his disciple into this dark and scary room. Once inside, once Grasshopper had accustomed his eyes to the light, the master said, "Be careful, Grasshopper. Don't go too near the pool of acid." And then you could see a few feet in front of Grasshopper, which is like indoor swimming pool. "Go a bit close, but be careful," said the master, "and tell me what you see." And so Grasshopper very carefully walked to the edge of the pool of acid. And on the bottom, there were bones. Human bones. "There were bones, Master. Human bones." "Yes," said the Master. "Those bones once belonged to novices like you." "What else do you see?" "I see a plank, Master, which goes from one side to the other." "Yes, little Grasshopper. That's the plank, which in a week's time, you will have to walk across. And I'm going to give you this 1 week of training, so I don't want you to join the bones at the bottom of that pool of acid." And it was very scary. And you could see Grasshopper was terrified. And if you'd have looked at me watching, you'd just see I was terrified. You could hit this movies on TV. So, they took Grasshopper outside. And in the courtyard of the temple was another plank, exactly the same length and size, but on two bricks. He said, "Grasshopper, you have nothing to do for the next week. No chanting, no meditation, no services, just learn to balance. In 7 days' time, you're going to have to walk across the pool of acid." So 7 days, Grasshopper was trying. It was so easy when it's over the courtyard. He could dance across it, go backwards. Even blindfold, he could walk across. But after 7 days came the test, the real thing. And you can see, even though Grasshopper was confident before, once he got into that very scary room, he wasn't all that confident at all. Because a plank of the same length over acid is much longer than a plank over solid ground. And much narrower too. So Grasshopper didn't want to go. And Master said, "Get on the plank, Grasshopper." And so Grasshopper had to get on the end of the plank. And he looked around pleadingly at the Master. You could read his eyes were saying, "Don't let me go, please." And Master just said, "Walk." And so the little Grasshopper had no choice. Even though he thought this was going to be the end of his life, even though he saw he was going to die because his legs started to wobble, they went like jelly once he started going over the acid. And you could see his step was very unsteady. You could see him start to wobble. And you could see the wobble begin to a very precarious swaying. And it looked like he was going to fall in. When? We had a commercial break. It's really terrible. It's just, people watch these things for entertainment. It's just suffering. That's what it is. Television. And just, you know what happens. Those commercials, they were just so inane and stupid, and you had to wait for them. But eventually, you were back again. And you were back, as usual, it's just a couple of frames before, just when he started to walk. And then he started to sway. And then we were back to that frame when he was about to fall in. And he fell in! And as soon as he fell in, the Master started laughing. And little Grasshopper was splashing around. And he soon realized it wasn't burning. And the Master said, "Don't worry, it's only water." And we put those bones down there for what we call these days special effects. The main thing is that Grasshopper, what pushed you in? Fear pushed you in, little Grasshopper. Fear pushed you in. And that was a whole reason for the object lesson. If Grasshopper had been told that was water to begin with, he would never have fallen in. But because he thought it was acid, fear drew him into the water. Now you understand why the only thing you ever need to be afraid of is fear. So, all these other things, don't be afraid. You're not afraid, things can't harm you. I've heard these, all these stories, and it's a person came to the Amdo who told me this. His old mother, and she must be about 70, this little grey-haired old lady, sort of, you know, just a small little thing. She caught a burglar in her house, this big, strapping guy. He said, "Oh, you're a naughty boy, you shouldn't do this." And she dragged the burglar out of the house and said, "Don't you ever come back again." And the burglar didn't know what to do. He just ran away. There's a big guy, it's only this little lady. But sometimes there are people like that, they're completely fearless. And when they're fearless, you don't know what to do. Yeah.
Something about fear. So everyone else has a fear of death.
Yeah.
And obviously death at the moment.
Yeah. This is like giving public talks. So always be prepared to give a talk, but never prepare your talk. So always be prepared to die, but don't prepare your death. So just prepare to die any old time. And it's great, as they say, to die here would be wonderful, because I could do your funeral on the spot. So you save a lot of money, because my funerals are very, very good, and they're very cheap. You go to Singapore, sometimes the funerals over there cost a fortune. So you get your money's worth over here. And the other thing, if you die while you're up in the air for a terrorist attack, you know the three benefits of actually dying in a terrorist attack on an aircraft? One of them. The first one is you get insurance payout for your family. Anywhere else you don't get insurance payout at all.
So out of compassion for your family, you know, it's great to die in a terrorist attack, you get free for sure for that. Number two, you get free cremation on the spot. So you don't have to worry about sort of taking it to this crematorium and that crematorium. And number three, you die close to heaven. What a great thing to do. So why be scared? Yeah, go on.
Many people say that they fear of death. But it's not that. I don't know fear of death today. Something of fear for sale goes to death. For example, like, if you die, you dead. But the process, like your illness, you know, your pain and all of that, like you have to go to hospital or you're disabled, you think, I thought the process is much more like fearful than actually.
Well, it's actually, for some people, you're asking, is the process of old age and sickness, especially the sickness prior to death, is that worse than the fear of death? And for some people, actually, even the fear of death is much stronger than the fear of the sickness. So actually, they'd rather still be sick, but not die. Even if the sickness is painful. But a lot of times, because they don't know what death actually is. So when you meditate, you know, you can actually understand what death is, you're not afraid of death anymore. You can remember your own death, you've done it many times. So when you actually remember you've done it many times, you find out what happens, and then you actually get skilled at it. It's just, you can do some market research in your own death. And you get all the tips for what's past.
Isn't there some meditation you can do on death itself?
Yes, I will die, that's for sure.
But then if you take medication, I thought you thought everything, you know, and then you still get disgusted and...
You don't get disgusted, you get free, you get disengaged from the body. Rodney, some years ago, he brought us a coffin for after the monks. The idea was, we have a nice coffin, we take turns sleeping in it at night. Yeah, just in that... Whenever you have a car, you test drive it first of all before you buy it. So we like test driving our coffins. The only thing is, the first time I could try that, it almost killed me. Because it was made of like this particle board. It was in an enclosed space, the fumes started coming off, and we almost died of the fumes. So that's the end of that coffin. But sometimes you can do things like that. So it's definitely a fairy death. Direct Empire, I was once asked by a friend, India is the origin of Buddhism. Why is it now more Muslim than Buddhist? Please kindly enlighten. Thank you for your message. It's actually, there's more Hindus and Muslims in India. There's quite a lot of Buddhists, but it's just because invasions. In the 12th century, the Muslims invaded the Turkish Muslims invaded India, and they basically wiped out all the Buddhists. So it was like through the sword. So it wasn't conversions, it was just killing everybody.
Wasn't it Chandacharya in the
7th
century?
No, it was, what's his name? Bhaktiya.
Converted them back into Canada. And then 300 years later, the Muslims came through.
It was actually the...
the Dasnami order of Chandacharya.
No, that was just turning a few of the Buddhists to Hindus. But this was actually the devastation of the Ganges Valley, especially like places like Nalanda. That was done, and Bodh Gaya as well. The heartland of Buddhism was destroyed by the Turkish invaders. And that was Bhaktiya. Yeah?
Can you still continue to gain merit after death if the act you did continues to...
Yeah, sure. Sure, so if you do one good act of good karma, you get results many, 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 many times. You plant one mango, you get many mangoes from that one mango. You get a whole tree of thousands of mangoes, and those thousand mangoes make even more mangoes. So one good act of kindness repays you many, many times. As does one bad act of stupidity. So it's not just like a one-to-one relationship karma. It's one many, many times over. So that's why one good act of karma, small investment, guarantee great returns. Dear Ajahn, it seems to me that the more empowered my mind becomes, the stronger my inclination to allow outflowing through talking or thinking about worldly responsibilities, etc. I am doing my best to be aware of, but not to heed, this inclination. How common is this concomitant increase in inclination, as there's a typical number of days before it passes? Okay, yeah, that's actually a good question. That is actually sometimes true. You get so much energy in the mindfulness gets very, very strong, and sometimes you waste it. You know, by actually talking or by thinking. Sometimes it happens, you get such a strong mind. Actually, you can, if you want to fantasize it, you can really do it properly for change. If you want to figure out your problems, you've actually just got a sharp mind, you can figure out all those problems very well, because you have some mind, you can follow a train of thought very, very carefully for a long period of time. But that's actually wasting the power of samadhi. In particular, this is one teaching of the Buddha which is very striking. He said that just before you get into the jhanas, he said there's the last, he called it lingering obstacle. He called it thinking about Dhamma. He said you should not do that. There comes a point your mind is so still and peaceful. You can take up some Dhamma, whether it's like impermanence or non-self, and you can actually give yourself the most amazing, insightful Dhamma discourse. And spend a whole hour, 2 hours, sort of thinking about Dhamma. You get great insights and wonderful inspirations. The Buddha said, stop it, don't do that. Because he said, that's almost like Mara's last trick. And then first of all, he tries to get you to go in the past or the future or fantasize or dream or whatever. If that won't work, okay, think about Dhamma. Because you think, oh, that must be okay. But the point is, if you stop thinking, instead of thinking about Dhamma, you'll see Dhamma. So he said, don't allow the power of the mind, which is now very strong at that state, just to lose the thread and start contemplating even wonderful teachings of the Buddha. It's not the time to contemplate yet. Keep it still, go deeper, and then you really have something powerful to contemplate, not just this old stuff. It's called Dhamma Vitaka, one of the last obstacles which can arise. You might get very, very deep. Your mind is now powerful. Now I can really start thinking about dependent origination or impermanence or self or whatever. But you do that and you give up your opportunity to get into the jhanas. It's called the lingering obstacle. So the Anguttara Nikaya in the threes. Very brilliant teaching.
So there is an increased tendency or inclination as the power increases if you're not used to it?
It's an increased ability of the mind. But then you misuse that ability.
Is there an increased desire to do that as well?
It's not so much an increased desire to do this, because because you have the ability, you haven't got the good teachings, the good instructions, sometimes you waste the abilities which you have. Just like a person who earns a great fortune, but then just wastes it on just silly, stupid things. You've done the work, you've got a great fortune. Now just take it a little bit further, and you can really make use of it.
How do you have a job towards the, you know, you said before, the thoughts of non-violence, renunciation, and compassion, inclining the mind towards absorption slash
jhana.
Then what you're saying is right at the doorway of jhana, they become a hindrance.
Correct.
What is the changeover called?
Changeover is, you use that, it's just the changeover from the menu to the food. Use the menu to see what's on offer. And once you've got the menu, you order the food. And once the food's on the table, you don't need the menu anymore. So those right thoughts, they're supposed to take you. That's a vehicle to get you somewhere. Just like the breath is a vehicle to get you somewhere. There's a time when you let go of the breath. I know that somebody once said that they started getting into a deep meditation, to a jhana, and their teacher said, when that nimitta came up, were you breathing in or were you breathing out? It's a stupid question. Because by that time nimitta's come up, you've lost the breath. It's nothing to do with the breath anymore. You've transcended that. The breath has done its job and now you're somewhere else. There is no breath perceivable there. So it's a silly question. The point being here is that you use the thought, as far as thought can take you, and you let go of thought. So by that time, there's no thought necessary. Yes.
When you have the mental power you're talking about, the mind gets stronger, and then it begins to get the answers and everything out of it. How can you if you're trying to be nice to the mind, you're saying, oh, I'm a nice mind.
Yeah.
But, so how do you stop it when it's got all strong like that?
Well, you just, you start with wisdom. Shh, quiet down. It's as if you're not really being so nice to the mind, because the mind wants to get deeper in, but you interrupt. So, oh, this is useful, I can make use of this. So you waste the opportunity. If you really are being kind to the mind, feeding the mind, you'll just want to go even more still, more peaceful. You won't sort of go off on that tangent, on that side road leading to nowhere. So that's why when you get very deep, you don't have to contemplate. Go deeper. And contemplation comes at the very end of the meditation, not in the middle. Get all the information, see how still you can be. At the very end. Like in an experiment, a scientist only just contemplates the results. Once the experiment is finished and all the results are in, you don't contemplate in the middle of the experiment. If you get your conclusions in the middle of the experiment, then you skew all the subsequent data. Anything which doesn't fit with your new theory, you just push away. That's why you contemplate the very end. Get deep, first of all. Next question. At which stage do you give the suggestion to the mind to go to the earliest memory during nimittas or in jhana? Would the suggestion or thought disturb the process and become the wow factor? Sometimes it can do. Usually the best time is really after jhana. And then you've got really lots of power, and then it, you know, usually works. But sometimes you can do it just before jhana. You know, if you've got into the sort of nimittas, and then, but the nimittas start and fade away, but you're still very peaceful, you've got a lot of joy. As long as you've got peacefulness and you've got joy, you've got some energy in the mind, you have to have a degree of stillness. Then you just suggest, what's my earliest memory? And a quiet. Just hold that quietness there, see if something comes up. If it comes up, it'll come up very quickly. Don't need to say that twice. If you have to say it twice, you're wasting your time completely. If it doesn't come up straight away, it won't come up at all. You have to have a mind which does what it's suggested. When the mind, when the mind is very still and peaceful, it's amazing what it can do. But, just for the interest of it, at least once or twice in the next few days, give it a try, see what happens. When you've got a nice deep meditation, and you know you've got another, say, 5 or 10 minutes, you think you're going to end it, they just say, okay, let's try it. That's my earliest memory. And see if something comes up. It's nice to do that at this particular time. That's all you have to do, just what is my earliest memory? See what happens. You don't have to be in the jhana, but after you come out of jhana, you're very empowered, so that, you know, it's usually very strong then. In the nimitta, I think you're too peaceful. But after the nimitta comes out, comes off, towards the end of the meditation, you've got power, you've got energy. Then try it. See who you were in the past. Okay? It's best to get a jhana, first of all, but if you can't get a jhana, try the past lives. Why are there people who are able to see ghosts and spirits? Is it a virtue factor, or is it just a frequency of that realm that they are able to receive? How can they turn that channel off? Okay. Sometimes people can see ghosts because they want to. Some people, they're just born that way. They see ghosts and spirits. Sometimes people see ghosts and spirits when they're very young. They can't see them again when they get older. But sometimes it is because a ghost or spirit which is very close to you, a good friend or a relation, you're the only one who sees them. And that must be because they are, you're almost like on the same frequency. You've lived with them and so you're attuned to them. So sometimes you may be in a room, you might see, you know, your old father or mother or something. No one else can see them because you're close to them. But you can develop the power of that through developing a strong mind. Sometimes people, they've got the ability, they just don't want to do that because they're afraid of seeing ghosts and spirits. And I say, you don't need to be afraid of those things. They are afraid of you. Don't believe me?
Okay, I'll tell one of my stories. When I was a monk, I told this story before, so I don't mind telling it again. Should have told it the first time. Once you tell it the first time, it's okay. Once, when I was a young monk in Thailand, now this was actually that monastery Wat Nana Chat. Before the monks were there, that actually even today it's a local cremation ground. All the villagers around bring their dead bodies there to cremate in a forest now called Wat Nana Chat. So if you want to see some ghosts, there are heaps of ghosts in that monastery. Full of them. That's where they get cremated. That's where people actually like. You know, the ghosts like to hang around since the monks are there. So there's lots of ghosts there. And they still keep burning more bodies, so there's more ghosts. And one night, okay, that was it, you left your body. I went to go visit the ghosts. When I went up to them, they ran away. Ah! We ran away. No, they were scared of me. I said, what are you scared of me for? I said, what, you can talk to us? I said, yeah. And so we had a chat afterwards. I talked to the ghosts and whatnot. And in the end, I asked them what you wanted. And they gave me this list of food. And the food they wanted most of all, which I remembered later on, was, it was called Nam Phit, the chili sauce. Really like sort of little playful things, that song. Because even when they're alive, they're Thai villagers, and they respect monks. Even when they're dead, they even respect monks even more. Because, you know, they're actually in a lower realm. You just, a monk is in one of the highest places in the human realm, which is higher. And they're scared of you. That's one thing I discovered. So they started running away. So you don't need to be afraid of ghosts. If there's any ghost which is giving you a hard time, you just tell them, be firm with them. Listen, if you're going to play around, you can play around over there, but don't play around in here, okay?
Did the guru ask you to bless?
No, I did ask to bless. Just, sometimes, that's a good thing for the ghost to do, but they were just more interested in their tummies than anything else.
When you die, you
check
the
person. Yeah.
How come you
got it? It's just one of the realms you get reborn into. The ghost realm, out of sometimes attachment, unfinished business. That's usually what happens. So, for example, you know, if you get murdered, say, and you hang around because you really want to get revenge, you want to make sure that your murderer never gets away, so you hang around as a ghost. Well, sometimes violent deaths, people don't realise they're dead. They hang around. And some of the other reasons, it might be that if it's your house there, then that's my house. And so sometimes people are so attached to their house, when they die, they just become a ghost there, because of attachment. Sometimes that's the case. So I'd never be attached to things. This is one of the lovely things, actually, to find out. If you see a ghost and you can talk to them, get a pen and paper out and interview them. You can do the first in-depth interview for the New Yorker. You can get it syndicated all over the world. Because isn't there some wonderful questions you can ask about ghosts? Like, do ghosts get married? And do they have baby ghosts? They only seem to come out during the night time, so when do they go during the day? And actually, do they eat? And how come they can sort of, like, you know, you can talk to ghosts in different languages? So you can actually ask, give it your first in-depth, and how do you really feel in your heart about being a ghost? What's it like? You know, they have celebrity interviews. Are there celebrity ghosts? You know, some of these famous people have died. And imagine if you actually got a real good interview with the ghost. Oh, you could make a fortune in the newspapers. So next time, don't say, go, leave me alone. Say, come in here, let's have a chat. So next time you see a ghost, you're very lucky. Don't waste the opportunity. Maybe only once in a lifetime you get the opportunity to interview a real ghost.
can ghosts be building up karma as well?
Yeah, but ghosts can be built up karma. So sometimes actually ghosts can do good things. Like, it's usually to say that some beings, they can't do any good things at all, but it's just much harder for ghosts to do good things. You know one of those beautiful stories about the ghosts? There's one story happened somewhere in Australia. An old man and an old woman, they were very good friends. They were staying in one of these old people's villages in units next to each other. And so he would help her if she needed any handiwork done. She would sometimes cook him meals. They were just best of friends. Maybe if they were younger, they might get married, but they were just too old for that. They were just friends. And when he told her, according to the story, that if he ever dies, please call his, I think his daughter or his sister. I think his sister, that's right, his sister in England. That was the only relation he had. And he died. And so she was, couldn't find any address or telephone number for the sister. So she was actually said she felt really so bad that she forgot to ask, you know, this man who she was looking after was a very good friend to. And now he's died, how he can tell his relations back in England. So one evening she woke up in her unit when somebody was stroking her face. She didn't know if she dreamt of this, but she was so scared she thought it was like an intruder, a burglar. And so she turned on the light, there was no one in the room, the door was locked, the windows were shut, no one in there. So she thought, that's really strange, I wonder what happened. And then, as she was watching, there was a tissue paper by the side of her, on her bed table. All the windows were locked, so there was no flow of air. The tissue paper lifted up, went off the table and then floated down on the ground. It's really spooky. She picked it up, and on that tissue paper was written a series of numbers. And at that point she realized what was happening. She picked up the telephone and just dialed those numbers. A voice came on the other end of the line and she said, I'm sorry to tell you that your brother died a few days ago. It was his sister. The ghost of the man who died wanted to help her, let her know that, to let her know the number of his sister so she could tell his sister that he died. It's a nice story. Sometimes ghosts can be helpful. Okay, so you don't have to be afraid of ghosts. Sometimes they're very cute. Yeah?
Can this ghost be
merited and then to
the next
rebirth
by the appropriate chanting, or is it only the ghost which still?
So it's sometimes that the chanting, or just doing merit for the ghost, that is sharing of good your good karma, helps the ghost. Sometimes if you do chanting, it can inspire the ghost. There's many, many ways you can actually encourage the ghost to feel good things. So chanting sometimes works, making good karma works, spreading loving kindness works. Sometimes, I mean, one of the nights, he was troubled by a ghost, he told the ghost to meditate. Come on, meditate. And there's a story in Thailand about that. This monk in Thailand, quite a famous monk, he bought this old house, or somebody donated the house, and there's a ghost in it, so the ghost came to the monastery as well. And the monk taught the ghost meditation. And then because the ghost learned meditation, she turned into a deva. That makes sense. So you can do all sorts of things. Dear Ajahn, the last few days have been fabulous. Thank you. But, no, this is but. How did the Buddha describe the end of this world? How is it triggered? What happens to all enlightened beings at that time? Do they become dinosaurs when planet Earth is formed again? Obviously considered one related question. Thank you. There's two or three questions. People are cheating all the time. That's true, huh? Okay. The end of the world. The end of the world and the beginning of the world. Where is it?
Now.
Now. That's right. Right inside you. So that's really what the end of the world is. But what they really mean is the end of the Earth. The end of the earth, how is it triggered? I like science. There is science. It depends upon the this number with, it's more than one or less than one, whether the universe would expand and end in a big whimper, or it would actually come back again, come to a big cataclysmic, another sort of big crunch. But whatever happens, big crunch or big whimper, that's the end of the world. But it's not going to happen for another 10 or 20,000 million years. So you don't have to worry about that on this retreat. But they say, what happens to the unenlightened beings? It's very fascinating. The Buddha actually said that when that universe ends, they mostly go into the first or second jhana realm. Basically, there's nowhere else to go. So, you know, you just get pushed in there. Because those are the jhana realms. Those are the jhana. Because they're completely devoid of the senses or body, the body gets disappeared, but it doesn't affect the mind. So that's where the place, where there's no other sort of places where they can actually incarnate in the body, so you just go to the mind realms, the jhana realms. So that's where many beings hang out, in the spaces between universal cycles. So because of that, there's been many universal cycles, so you have been in those jhana realms before. But just a long time ago, and you've all forgotten. Next question. How can a tiger practice five precepts? It's a strange question.
Tiger.
No, not Thai girl. Tiger. How can a tiger practice five precepts? I suppose. Do you mean Tiger Woods? Just like hunters have to hunt to survive and feed the family and monks, how can they be alleviating their karma if they are stuck in that circle? Just like a person who's born in a family who's a chicken, who has a chicken abattoir all his life, he's just about killing chickens. Nobody told him that this is wrong, that is in fact life, to earn money for family. They don't know till even they die. How do they get out of this cycle? Do they just align themselves at some stage of their lives, or is it just a matter of time? Sometimes, obviously, if it's just a tiger who kills for food, sometimes that's much different than if you kill just for the fun of it, like some sports people or hunters or fisher people. But I tell some people, in Western countries, people like to go fishing. So some of my disciples, they have a hard time. They said, I want to go fishing, but I want to keep the five precepts. What should I do? I said, okay, why do you go fishing? Is it to catch the fish or just the piece? Just the piece of it. So that's very good. So you can go fishing. You can have your line, you can have your rod, you have the floats, but don't put the hook on the end of the line. And then it's even more peaceful. You throw the line in there, and you can sit there, and you don't have to be worried by getting any bites. It's even more peaceful than before. You're not doing any bad karma. So that's not really why I go fishing. We all go fishing to catch things, to excite them at it, so it is bad. So the point is that once there was one of Ajahn Chah's disciples, he was a poor villager. This is actually the answer to this question here. He was a very, very poor villager. And he went to see Ajahn Chah, he got a lot of inspiration, so he wanted to take the five precepts. But he had a problem because as a poor villager, the only way you could feed your family was by catching fish in the rivers and in the paddy fields during the monsoon season. And it was like basically a rice and fish diet, and maybe a few leaves, there was no vegetables. So he said, what should I do? I have to catch fish to feed my family, but I want to keep the five precepts. So Ajahn Chah, this great teacher, he said, okay, catch fish, but just enough to feed your family. Don't catch any to sell. In the meantime, come see me every few days or every week, and I will teach you a new trade. Because like many of those monks in those days, they had to learn herbal medicine. It was actually common, even when I was a young monk, to go walking through the forest or jungle with another elderly monk, and they'd point out, see this plant over here, that's good for diarrhea. That one over there is good for fever. This is good for if you've got a cut. It was actually common knowledge amongst the forest monks about what plant was useful for what. They were all herbalists.
because there was no other doctors. So Ajahn Chah was very knowledgeable about the properties of those herbs. And so he taught this man, his name was Paul Am, he taught him all that he knew about herbal medicine. And in about 6 or 7 years, this man, Paul Am, became a local herbal doctor. He never needed to catch another fish again. And then he could keep the five pieces purely. And that's the great wisdom of a teacher like Ajahn Chah. If he had said, no, you can't catch any fish, that man would have died, and so would his family probably, or they'd gone into such great poverty, it was completely impractical. But he taught him, let's be practical about this. You've got no choice, you have to catch fish, but just catch enough fish to eat, not to sell, and in the meantime, you can actually solve the problem by teaching another trade. That's actually the great wisdom of a teacher. So, if it's a tiger, you actually teach the tiger about vegetarian fish. Ajahn, is it possible to attain jhanas on a non-silent retreat? And also, what are the effects of allowing smoking on a retreat? Apart from being harmful to the body, does smoking affect the meditation in more subtle ways? Thank you. P.S. Hint for other retreatants. I've skillfully and seamlessly combined 3 questions into 1 by use of punctuation. Is it possible to take jhanas on a non-silent retreat? Yeah, of course it is, because it's not other people's noise which is the problem, it's your noise which is the problem. The sound doesn't disturb you, you disturb the sound. Yeah, so it's possible, yeah. So I've only answered 1 question. First question. The way you related in deep meditation this morning just let me think that the human being is like a robot. The will of a person is just like an operating software for a computer. The will is also like genetic of human race. Finally, I'll try to be a computer. Here we go. The will is also. Hang on, we're good, sir. I lost my place. The human being is like a robot. The will of a person is just like an operating system for a computer. The will is also like genetic of human race. Finally, there is nothingness in the fourth jhana, so there is no self. Since we create computer, can there be a possibility of a creator for a human being too? Okay. So if there's a creator for a human being, who created the creator? And where does the will of the first being come from? Your will is completely conditioned. And if God had no choice, is there really free will at all? Obviously, no. So you don't need to have like a creator. You have a creating, which is always going on, not just first, but always happening. You are creating the world in every moment. Your will is the creator. And it never stops until you stop. And when you stop, then the world ends. So you can see, as long as you're creating worlds, you're creating, filling in, colouring up the world with your likes and dislikes. That is the smoking. So do we allow smoking in this retreat? No, there's no smoking. No smoking of the mind. Smoke, 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 smoke. Good. All the heat you're generating inside. That way. So that you understand that, yeah, okay, there is like a robot. But can you actually create artificial intelligence? If you had like a really advanced computer, can like a stream of consciousness from a past life go into that computer and take that as its new birth? Can we have another level of cosmology? Not just the hellish beings and the ghosts and the what's the other one? The human beings and the animals and the devas. Can we have a new level of beings, the computers, the supercomputers? But I know this one story which I've been telling people during the Range retreats about this one time monk. You talk about psychic powers, and this is a psychic power in the US recently. And you can see how certain it is that something strange happened, because this was a monk called
Ajahn Jamnia, a Thai monk, very old contemporary of Ajahn Chah. And recently we found out, because he visited one of our monasteries in the US, we found out that he's been given a diplomatic visa to enter the United States whenever he wants for the rest of his life. In these ages of terrorism, how is it that an old Thai monk has been given such a visa? So he asked him the story. And this is a true tale. Some years ago, in Texas, in Houston, in the headquarters of the National Aeronautical and Space Agency, NASA, they installed a new computer. And the new computer was having troubles. Even the old little computer in Normal has troubles. This was a big one in NASA. And, unlike our little place, they had all the experts. They had the money to hire these experts. They got the best experts in the US to try and fix up the problems with their new computer, but no one could fix it up. They tried and they tried and they tried until one of the computer experts suggested, "We've tried everything we know. Perhaps it is something supernatural." And they knew there was this Thai monk in town. So they invited him into the headquarters of NASA, into their main computer room, and asked him to do his stuff. He chanted, he meditated, and after he finished his meditation, that computer started working perfectly. And out of gratitude, the US government gave him a diplomatic visa for the rest of his life, to come and go whenever he wants. It's a good story, it's true. So, if you have any trouble with your computers, so that sometimes there are sort of, you know, maybe ghosts do get in those computers, and he got rid of it. It's a good story, isn't it? Nice story. Next question. In Sri Lanka and chanting, there are transference of merits at the end to devas and departed relations. Do devas and departed relations really get the merits deriving out of the chant? What if the departed relations have long passed away and maybe you've brought another realm? Can they still enjoy the transference? Sort of, if they're in many realms, they can get those transference. The sutras say that only in the ghost realm can they get the transference, but sometimes you can actually contact people in all sorts of realms. They may not get the full transference, but they get a lot of it. And if your relations who have got reborn in good realms don't get it, some will get it. So it's worthwhile doing. We'll do that at the very end of the retreat. Dear Venerable Sir, you encourage us to have present moment awareness and find a little way. It seems the teachings you shared with us about Rumpo Cha were very extreme. Please comment. Which ones were those? There's lots of extreme teachings. They're all done with kindness. But the middle way, sometimes that it's like someone is leading to the left and you ask them to go to the right. Sometimes they're going to the right. You ask them to lean to the left, so they go the middle way. So a smart teacher knows how to find the middle way. And what's the middle way for you may not be the middle way for somebody else. So what seems tough for a monk in Thailand may actually be the middle way for him. So we can't judge others. But I think, obviously, that Ajahn Chah knew the middle way, because it certainly worked. He had many great disciples. It wasn't too extreme. Maybe you're talking about when we used to go in the room with all our blankets on in the hot weather. I don't know if that's what you meant. What else did Ajahn Chah do which was extreme? Actually, many things. But he did it with a kind heart. Many other things worked. So experimented. And I think, I'm always very grateful for him. I never thought he was like an extremist. Does blessings by monks works? Blessing when a child is born, when a person gets married, when you have a new house, when you die. How long does the effects last? Yeah, blessings.
blessings work. You get lots of donations from blessings. Works for the Buddhist Society. You better stop. It does actually work. Some of the blessings, they do work. And it's been proved. I've actually got the article in my room in Serpentine. There was an experiment done by many universities collaborating in California, a double-blind study on AIDS patients, where they got not just Buddhist monks, Catholic priests, indigenous Indians, rabbis, to chant on a list of names. Some of those names were made up and fake, some were actually real patients with AIDS in the hospitals in California. Only half the patients who had AIDS in California were on the list, half weren't on the list. And no one knew who was on the list and who wasn't, who was real or was not real. And they gave this questionnaire to the doctors who were treating these AIDS patients, very simple question. In the last couple of weeks, has this person got better than expected, as expected, or worse than expected? Now, there's a huge number of samples there, a huge number of patients. And they wanted to find out whether those were charted on, they never knew they were being charted on, whether they got better or they got worse, or just stay the same, whether there was an effect or no effect. And they found out there was a very, very significant effect. Those ones who got charted on, prayed on, whatever it was on, they had a significant increase in their health. It was actually reported in Time magazine. That's where we first saw it, and I got the original paper. I forget which journal it was in. I printed that out and got a copy for myself. Chanting does work. It doesn't have to be Buddhist. It's just a fair fact. You spend your time thinking about a person, wishing them well. And it works. Dear Ajahn, why did Ajahn Jagro disrobe with metta? That was a long time. So, I'll give you his address, you can go and ask him. Is it necessary to read suttas for a lay Buddhist? What if we do not understand Pali? How do we know the translated versions are close to its original meaning? Do we just buy them off the bookshops? Or is there other particular production that we can something only? Okay, if you really get into Buddhism and meditation, it's actually quite good to read the suttas, and there's some very good English translations. Done mostly by Bhikkhu Bodhi, who's a great, brilliant translator, and they're pretty close, almost close, 100% accurate. So you can get hold of those, not actually 100% accurate, there's a few faults in them, but they're pretty good. So that's why it's worthwhile, you can actually read those for yourself. And when you read them for yourself, all these questions you are asking about, all these old ideas, can you get attached to jhana, did you get a jhana, will you go into those lower realms after you die or whatever, you can find the answer to those yourself. And sometimes they're eye-openers to read those suttas. I mentioned that Gatikara Sutta about a Buddha's past life. There's a Brahmin who was bad-mouthing the Kassava of the Buddha. And that sort of shows, hang on, this idea of bodhisattvas, of always being so pure for many, many lifetimes, that doesn't fit. So when you read these things for yourself, you get some very, very good information. And you can understand some of these things for yourself. And any sort of argument which monks have, do you have to get jhana to become enlightened? Can you do pure vipassana? Do you have to be a monk or a nun? All those sorts of questions, you can find out the answers for yourself because you read it for yourself. So it's fascinating to do that. And they are available in every bookshop, such as the Buddhist Society of West Australia. Ajahn, two children from same parents brought up together without any difference in treatment or environment, one becomes a monk and the other a criminal. What is the conditioning factor that causes a difference in the two? Kindly elaborate on different types or degrees of conditioning. Sometimes it's just the karma they've been from the past. Sometimes they come into the same womb, but one has brought all their karma from the past and maybe sort of some unpleasant karma. Mom got the good karma from the past and they have a good life. So that way it can't be the upbringing, it can't be genetics. To say that everything is genetics is really obviously wrong because
have cases like that. Two people in the same family, sometimes identical twins, they turn out completely different. That's a karma we pick from the past. Woo. There's a long one here, but it says at the top, don't be afraid, only one question in here. But it's a long one. Okay, make this the last one. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I know Samyak is a great master who even doesn't tell our disciples what to do and what not to do. And I know you are a great master. That's very nice. Well, maybe I'll stop there. Who even doesn't tell our disciples what to do and what not to do? It gives some subtle hints sometimes and waits until they themselves understand it and it's put into action. But unfortunately, some people are so ignorant they can't see you and see you in point, especially on, they can't see you something in point, especially on vegetarianism. I know some people who go to the farm to choose the best chicken and offer dana. They want to do their best, so they go and choose the healthiest one. They think that it should be killed to offer, as in time you didn't have any choice other than to eat what they offered us because the vegetables were so rare. I think in Perth we have plenty of vegetables and fruits to sustain all of us. I think it's time for you to get these people out from harming and killing animals, whether they eat it or not, but at least to not kill living innocent animals for dana. This only should benefit all humankind and to animals. How can the monks think they are keeping the five precepts when the animals are being killed for them? Panatipata. Even if someone doesn't kill directly, but if they create the demand for meat supply, doesn't it the same karma you get from it? Knowing we sponsor all the meat shops out there because we buy them. I got this VCD about what goes behind the screen, how animals are raised and how they're killed, blah blah. Something that we don't get to see. Please set this for people to watch. Yeah, watch it and understand what real compassion is. The thought came to my heart and I could hold it back. Please forgive me. May you be well and happy. Please go. Okay. This is just about vegetarianism and just like monks, nuns, lay people about eating meat and not eating meat. Again, I was a very strict vegetarian when I was a lay person. It's something I told you I think I had to give up as a monk. I tried several times to be a vegetarian when I was a monk. Sometimes it just didn't work. The one time and the last time when I gave up was when I went to a house down at somebody's house. I won't tell you who it was, but they decided that day, because they wanted to give what they thought was the very best. They had some rice, but there was no vegetables, there was no fruit, there was no sweets. There was every different type of meat you could possibly imagine. Every type of meat dish. And it was, that's what it was rice and meat. And I just took the rice, and I embarrassed the host, because I still had my vow of vegetarianism. And after that I thought, you've got to give that up. You try to encourage vegetarianism as a monk, but you can't actually keep it. You have to open your bowl to all sorts of food, whatever the person wants to give to you. And that's what the Buddha actually said for monks. That, you know, your job is actually to be not choosing and to allow yourself to be a receptacle for people's generosity. And sometimes people aren't vegetarians and they want to feed you. Sometimes they don't know anything other than their meat, so they give it to you. At least you should put it in your bowl. Sometimes you don't eat it, that's fine. If you've got the opportunity, like on retreats, fine, let's be vegetarian on retreats, because at that you have some control. But even here, I think one of the days we've got some meat dishes, some chicken dishes. But also, remember, as a vegetarian, that sometimes you eat vegetables, you eat rice, but that is also at the expense of animals' lives. And that's not to be discounted. Because when, you know, you're being in those areas where rice is made, and whenever you plough the fields, always there's birds waiting after the plough to pick off all of the animals which have been either broken by the plough or been unearthed. When you see all that destruction of the plough, that you realize when you eat rice or when you eat meat, there's so much destruction in the food you eat. Even as a vegetarian, I would never wear leather shoes. I couldn't get plastic ones. I remember going to a shop and say, is this plastic or is this leather? And they thought I was crazy. We were about to call the police. So I decided to go and make my own shoes. It lasted 2 days before they completely fell apart. But I was really trying hard. So these days, I realize that the job of compassion, when it's aligned and it's in line with wisdom, is actually to, there's no way you can avoid the killing of beings. Your job is to limit it as much as you possibly can. So it's not to be 100% pure, because that's an impossible goal. You have to limit it and try, if you are having food, at least don't waste it, if at all possible. And if you have to have meat, and I know our local doctor complains that some of our monks are vegetarian, and he said that's why they keep having to go to the doctor. But no, I don't know. Someday if you can take vegetarian food, fine, that's encouraged. But if you can't, you can't. So don't worry about what other people do. Worry what you're doing. That's one of those questions which is, it's an impossible one to please people on. So if you can be a vegetarian, wonderful. Try your very best. If you bring food to the monasteries, please bring vegetarian food, if at all possible. But if you can't, that's fine too. Okay, because whatever you do, there's always a result of some animals get killed. So, be careful. Try and be kind. Of all the animals which have sacrificed their life for you so far, make sure their sacrifice is not in vain. Make sure the food which you've eaten, the mosquitoes you've squashed, all of the bugs which were on the windscreen of the car when you came here, because you came here at night time. Make sure their lives are not in vain. Make sure that you practice well, so their sacrifice for your well-being means that they can get a good rebirth, because their sacrifice has been used for your enlightenment, at least your good karma. So that way, just like when I receive dharma, if my practice is good, then those who gave to me, the merits will be increased. So may the merits of all the insects and other people who sacrifice their life for you, may their sacrifice not be in vain. Practice well. The night is still young. So the last time didn't work. So if you've got good mind, carry on meditating. Make yourself peaceful and see what happens. And then maybe, when this one less person reborn, and that's one less cow has to die, because it's one less mouth to feed in the world. So, make this your last life, for the sake of other beings. Okay? Okay, the other question we'll keep till tomorrow, because, hey, this is a strange question. Because we run out of time. Have a nice night. See you in the morning.